black, white, and colorless. If you could mine salt from their grief and tears, Slavyansk would be a leader of salt making. This article is published in partnership with Ukraine Lab and has been translated from Ukrainian by Nina Marie. The air is so heavy in the summer, you can hardly move your feet. Your body becomes heavy and it feels like your nostrils are made of brick. You gasp for breath like fish beached by a powerful ocean wave. It is hard to tell if this is because of the bright steppe sun or the dust that warms its way into your clothes and skin. I cannot fathom how the miners, who must wear their protective overalls every day and climb down into the guts of the blazing hot earth, survive in temperatures like this. I never asked my father about this. He used to work as a power engineer at a mine. In winter, it's a little easier, but the winds can be so strong they send the very ground under your feet skittering in every direction. The local road crews would put salt on the iced Donbass roads. This did not always prevent injuries, but it made it necessary to clean the white rosettes of salt off your black fake leather shoes every night. The time was the late 1990s and the beginning of the new millennium. The bright colors of childhood were painted in the shades of gray every day. And yet, this unruly industrial poetry mesmerized me. Exact sciences were entirely foreign to me. I always wondered, how much salt does there need to be in this country to make it okay to put it on our minor roads? So many of us traveled them. One of the people that walked the roads of my city was the photographer Alexander Shekmenev. In the early 2000s, he made his most famous series, The Donbass, about the poverty of the region, its social challenges, and the self-sacrifice required to mine coal. In fact, it is about more than a century-old vicious cycle of these problems, anchored to mankind's abusive dependence on natural resources. Salt. Let's check our watches. At 15 Kyiv time on 4th of April, the workers of mine number 4 of the state-owned enterprise Artemisil in Soledar in the Donetsk region finished their shift. They all received their pension credit records and left in different directions. Everyone was expecting a Russian assault in the Donetsk and Lugansk regions since the beginning of the full-scale invasion, but few had imagined its scale and cruelty. Industries that underpin entire cities are being shelled constantly, critical and civilian infrastructures being destroyed, housing razed. The old utopia was born underground, salt, coal, and gas, but there is no need to drill to find the new one. It is right on the surface. Artemisil had to halt its production because of this. Two-thirds of the city's population left. Some were leaving for the second time after they had fled here from the war and from Russian mercenaries to start new lives 8 years earlier. And now the ground was slipping again from under their feet. The ground is caving. This is not a wartime metaphor, but a real prospect, unless salt and coal mining enterprises can return to work. There are no lacunae in nature, the resources geologist Mikhailo Kurishov tells me. Kurishov was born in Kharlivka, moved to Bakhmut in 2015 because of the war, and now lives in the Kyiv region. When a mine shaft stops being worked, water will fill the empty space. This water erodes the larger structures of the mine and rises to the surface where it might form a salt lake. I have swum in one. There are salt lakes outside of Slavyansk and Donetsk region with a resort built around them. The last time I went was August of 2014. The intolerable Donetsk sun was blazing hot, and it felt like time itself slowed down in the heat. Exhausted Ukrainian soldiers wandered around the resort. My photographer, Mykola Timchenko and I stopped to take a picture by a tank named Swallow. These were the members of the 95th Special Paratrooper Brigade, the future of cyborgs of the Donetsk airport. One of them got married the same year or soon after and has two sons now, but he's still at the front. Just went home on leave in June for the first time since the full-scale invasion. Yevgraf Kovalevsky, a 19th century Kharkiv scholar, believed Slavyansk salt lakes to have formed as a result of a near-surface salt-bearing strata being eroded by groundwater. Salt mining was never as developed here as it has been in the Bakhmut, in Bakhmut or Soledar. In this early days, salt was mined chemically, which eroded the soil, created cavities, and provoked many mine collapses. In 1935, the authorities made the decision to work all salt deposits exclusively by artificial subterranean leaching. This practice lasted until the beginning of World War II. The years of fighting and occupation exhausted the industry. Ground caved. Homes collapsed. In 1961, the authorities closed down the central salt mining operation in Slavyansk for good. Time stopped. My imagination often turns to the Ukrainian futurists who had once envisioned my region as a utopia and came here in search of rhymes and life. They thought the future would be dynamic and fast-paced, so time ran faster on their watches. The writer and journalist Alexei Poltoratsky walked these steps and imagined himself roaming the bottom of an ocean that used to exist an astronomical number of years ago. He was not wrong. There had been, in fact, a large body of water in the present-day Donetsk region, but a sea, not an ocean. It was this sea that left behind salt deposits. Unfortunately, I know very little about Poltoratsky, aside from a handful of his writings I read, but I inhabit the future he had imagined and find myself at the same crossroads, reflecting on my own life and the life that will come after mine. Perhaps this is the most powerful thing that connects us. It feels to me now that the winter days when I walked salted roads were also an astronomical number of years ago. Paradoxically, temporality can crumble or concentrate exactly like a lump of raw salt, the kind that Bakhmut carpenter and self-taught artist Yegor Popov used back in 1889 to carve 122 meters underground the statue of the salt general Nikolai Letunovsky, and then owner of the Bryansk mines, now Artemisil. Slightly yellowed with time, the statue is still held in the Donetsk Regional History Museum. The Russian Tsar has stripped Letunovsky of all his titles and duties. Later, however, he was celebrated as the man who opened the industrial chapter in the life of the city. Never mind that salt mining had been practiced here long before the Industrial Revolution. Be that as it may, the 2-meter general, now nearly faceless, has survived 2 empires. He'll survive the 3rd yet. How much time would it take for the water to fill these mines? I asked Kuleshov. 20 to 30 years, perhaps, he said. Coal. It has been 2 years since the groundwater began to flood the illegal open-air coal pit near the Lysychansk gelatin factory. No one knows the exact chemical content of that water, and yet a few locals have already taken a swim in it. They say it's as deep as a 5-story building, and you might very well drown. The residents of Lysychansk baptized this place the Lysychansk Grand Canyon. It does look awesome. The pit is filled with blue-green water and surrounded by ruby-colored sandy bluffs, dotted with green shrubbery. Birds circle overhead, insects buzz. The only downside is the smell of animal bones from the factory nearby. Local right defenders and environmental activists have been reporting that illegal pit to authorities since 2017. They have filed at least 8 complaints, and the illegally mined coal as well as the mining equipment have been arrested at least as many times. The criminal investigation, however, did not begin until 2020. Even before the war, Luhansk and Donetsk regions looked pockmarked from space. The gaping holes of illegal pits are easy to spot on Google Maps. The number of these wounds is growing now. There are also holes left by exploding mortars, craters from airdrop bombs, and the graves of soldiers and civilians. People used to mine illegally on the sites, rich in high-grade anthracite coal. My hometown was famous for it, but since the war began in the spring of 2014, these pits have sprung up everywhere. Conservationists raised alarm. Pit mining harms the environment and is no way a rational use of natural resources. Economists warned of the corruption and shadow markets. Rights advocates spoke out about the absence of safety measures or local or social benefits. Miners face the risk of injury or death at the state-owned mines as well, but at least those provided a safety net. Illegal pits offered no assurance of any kind and would hire even high schoolers. Boys like the 14-year-old Yura Sikanov from the town of Snizhne in the Donetsk region. Mine number 8, the documentary film about him, traveled across half of Europe in 2010, but was not allowed into the festival circuit in Ukraine. The film tells the story of a very young man taking responsibility for his family when his father dies and his mother abandons her 3 children. His decision to work illegally is a forced one. Yura became a hero for his 2 younger sisters, but most of Snizhne residents did not share their view. 2 years later, the boy was severely beaten, his jaw broken. The film was accused of slandering the real Donbass, a heroic and striving region with no room for poverty or black markets where the industry played an important role. But the industry was, in fact, playing its own game. My grandmother came from Western Ukraine. She broke the law when she was 15 to have years added to her record so she could go to work. So she went. They sent her to Pustia coal carts. They had to fire her eventually because she started coughing blood. I'm speaking to Alexander Chekhmenev in a cafe near Levoberezhne metro station in Kiev. It is late September 2014 and the war has been going on for 6 months. Chekhmenev has just returned from Slavyansk where he photographed residential buildings shelled into rubble by the Russians and their proxies. In these pictures, exhausted, hopeless people stand against the background of the ruin. If you could mine salt from their grief and tears, Slavyansk would be a leader of salt making, unless, of course, their tears became a lake. Gas. I am talking to Chekhmenev about his photographs and his connection to the region. He shot the series I consider the most poignant, Passport in Luhansk region, during the period when Ukraine was issuing its first passports to its citizens. Chekhmenev helped local workers who visited the elderly and took portraits in people's homes. Among the citizens of the new state were men and women in their 90s who had their own death, not a political renaissance, on their minds. One of Chekhmenev's subjects had a coffin placed preemptively next to his bed. The poor home's interiors remained outside the frames of the passport photos, but were still there, like worn-out stage sets in Chekhmenev's pictures. He took his photographs in 1994, all of them breathed with cold. Some subjects wrapped themselves in blankets, others are wearing thick sweaters. Most of the homes Chekhmenev visited were heated with coal. Miners could buy a coal at a discount, but it was still not cheap. People saved by keeping their homes frigid. Gas was considered a more progressive and environmentally friendly option. None of Chekhmenev's subjects gave it any thought, however. They were preparing to trade the cozy feeling of their homes for the warmth of the ground that would soon take them. In the early 2006, there was first talk of the natural gas deposits in the sandy soils of the Yusuf Basin, which encompasses parts of the Donetsk and Kharkiv regions, right next to the country of salt lakes, pine forests, and the incredibly clear air where we took the pictures of the iron swallow. One struggled to imagine a few mining operations in that landscape. Gas lies in the deep strata of sandy soils, and the wells could be as deep as 4,500 meters. This could, in turn, affect the groundwater and the entire ecosystem. The environmental risk and feasibility analysis were never completed, primarily because of the war. In 2014, the company that ran explorations for Shell stopped operating with the notice that it was taking a hiatus in our ground operations. In mid-February of 2021, the national concern, Naftogaz, also threw in the towel. Let the gas stay under the ground at this price. Today, the Yusuf Basin is one of the first front lines. The Donetsk and Lugansk region have often been called the land of black and white gold, coal and salt, but the real treasure is gas, an invisible compound that is now tightening the energy dependence noose around European nations. For 8 years since the annexation of Crimea and the occupation of parts of Luhansk and Donetsk regions, the war for most European politicians remained as amorphous, as invisible as natural gas. As amorphous and as invisible as natural gas. Only now has the wind from Ukraine brought over the acrid smell of gas and burning. For the large part, this invisibility was the result of Russian media campaign that manipulated historical knowledge and the facts of Ukrainian frontier. In fact, the only thing that Moscow is after is resources, including the human one. The Soviet propaganda cast the workers of Donbass as brothers of the Titan Prometheus, who first sculpted human beings out of mud and then gave them fire and its heat. Unlike their half-divine imaginary kin, however, the people of Donbass were not invincible. Every day, these miners did back-breaking work, climbed down into the guts of the earth like moles, denying themselves daylight and losing their health and sometimes lives. The propaganda machine kept silent about their occupational illnesses and the high rate of mortality in the mines. Only their very particular cough and the black circles around their eyes reminded of the cost they paid, the coal dust that no soap could wash off. The only thing that remained invincible was their strong, literally pathological kinship with the land. Unlike the Ukrainian futurists, the Eastern Ukrainian farmers saw the change in their land's landscape as an act of violence done to their own bodies and identities. They saw industrialization as a form of violence, while they cared about their land as if it were a member of the family. They made sure the soil did not erode or get washed out by planting winter wheat or rye to give the land a chance to rest and renew itself. Today, the fields of wheat and rye are also burning. The fire that Prometheus has given to people is put at the service of death and destruction. Industrialization, meanwhile, just like photography, is part of our modern history. Industrialization is appealed to the future. Photography has always been about the past. War keeps taking the future away, as do the forces of migration and deportation, poverty, hunger, changes of climate, and new diseases. The past requires constant vigilance. Archives and cultural heritage are being destroyed. My own analog photo archive did not survive the blaze of artillery in March of 2022 and turned into dust under a Russian barrage. As a token of memory, I have a portrait of myself taken against the backdrop of the empty, burned-out walls, but it was not the first time I had stood amid my ruins. I had only been to my grandfather's village once. Not one knew my grandfather's history well. My grandmother never showed me her family pictures. Stacks of them gathered dust in her wardrobe for many years until she died. Grandfather had died before the war. Wars and revolutions had destroyed that village. Industrialization and the empire not only occupied the local landscapes, but also wore out, swallowed the dreams of my grandfather's family, once potters who became coal miners. We took a family picture against the background of the devastated landscape where the Ukrainian church and my grandfather's parents' house had once stood. They lived here in the 1920s. They were deported in 1938, rehabilitated in 1954. We came back in the 2000s. I wonder what the pottery my great-grandparents made looked like, and imagine myself putting flowers into a vase shaped by their hands. I wonder what the clay felt like, the clay that gave them strength and inspired them to make new things. But I don't have that knowledge or those artifacts. I don't even have that picture with the vanished village in the background, a century of my family's biography. That's what I'm trying to put back together like a broken jug. I also think about my own connection to this land, the late summer wind and the sharp smell of thyme that sends me like a magic potion instantly home, where the silver manes of the needle grasses wrap the earth like waves of an ocean, where holes in the roads are filled with coal, slag, and in winter the snow is dusted with salt. where the roots of the plants are so strong they grow in the abandoned rusted frames of factories, reclaiming what's theirs, where the faceless salt general is counting down the time left in the life of a third empire, where everything that looks at first black and white assumes bright colors and comes to life. Just like the propaganda trains that Vasil Yermilov painted with flowers before they went cruising the local rails in the early 1900s. My memories might be closer to a futuristic epic rather than a reality on the ground. In reality, the Times and Needle grasses might not survive the war. They lack the resilience of the enormous numbers of machines and explosions. And to help the Salt General see political change, Ukrainian soldiers dig trenches and watch sunrises and sunsets from them. The best of them become the salt of that earth, and the cost of it cannot be measured. Scholars argue about the exact moment the modernity ended and whether we are still processing its demise. I am interested in a different question. Did its end also signal the death of all its visions of the past and future, so that the only thing we have today is the present, where time is measured not by the hands of a clock, but by the firing of an air defense system, and it stops the crawl of a reborn imperialism? In the last centuries, futurists suddenly found themselves in our times. Would they be disappointed? If the last century's futurists suddenly found themselves in our times, would they be disappointed? We have tense rhymes, cryptic words, and then everyday struggle for survival. As we survive air raid alarms and our own anxieties, endure loss, pain, and the destruction of our native city, what we want most, more than ever before, is to gulp up our freedom, to fight for each lungful of it like the parched, beached fish. The old utopia was born underground, born of salt, coal, and gas, but there is no need to drill into the sand to find the new one. It is right here on the surface. We are the shelf of the ocean that will live here as an astronomical number of years later. Let's check our watches. Mine tells me it's year 8 and day 162 of war. The empire is being counted down. The author, Katerina Yakovlenko, is a Luhansk-born Ukrainian visual art researcher and writer. Among her publications is the book Why Are There Great Women Artists in Ukrainian Art? Why There Are Great Women Artists in Ukrainian Art, and the special issue Euphoria and Fatigue. Okay, I don't know if you actually want me to read this part, but I hope this works. I'm sorry that this is so informal. Thank you for letting me read this beautiful piece and reflect on it. And I hope you're doing as well as you could be. Sending hugs.